right. Well, good afternoon. My name is Charles-Philippe Lajoie.
Chuck.
It's easier. I'm a PhD candidate at McMaster University working with Allison Sills. And today I want to briefly present to you what I'm working on. Basically, we want to model mass transfer in binary systems. As you'll see, this is a rather challenging project. We've been mostly dealing with numerical problems so far, and we haven't done much science, but we feel like we're almost there. All right, so before I just go into the heart of my talk, I just want to give you a brief outline. So I'm going to start with a... I'm going to tell you why we want to model mass transfer in binary system, and also the context in which we want to model these systems. I'm going to say a few words on how we plan on modeling these systems. We have we've introduced this rather new technique to do that, and I'm going to say a few words on the problems we're having right now that are still not solved, actually. All right, so why model mass transfer? Well, since I'm working with Allison, you may have guessed, Blue's trackers, right? So as probably most of you know, Blue's trackers are thought to be formed either by stellar collisions or mass transfer in binary system, either primordial or dynamically formed. The thing is, no one exactly knows if there is a difference between these two scenarios, right? An observational signature. On the theoretical side of the picture, the collisional scenario has been extensively studied, namely by James Lombardi and Allison Sills. And the main result from these simulations is that collision products don't really mix. So it's actually hard to rejuvenate these stars. It's hard to bring fresh hydrogen at the center of these stars. I'm not saying collisions don't form Blue's trackers. I'm just saying it can be harder. Interestingly, there were a few papers recently that have suggested that Blue's trackers may indeed form and are also found in binary system. There is a paper that Nathan was just talked to us about, the Kennedy, Lee, and Sills. Nature letter, where they found a correlation between the number of Blue's trackers in the core versus the mass of the core, which they interpreted as a binary nature for these Blue's trackers. There's also observational evidence for that. A paper from Geller et al. 2008. It's a survey of the NGC 188, I think, where they found that some of their Blue's trackers show radial velocities, which are suggestive of a binary companion. And for those of you who were around a few weeks ago when Francesco Ferraro presented a tutorial or a talk on Blue's trackers, there's also other signatures suggestive of mass transfer, and the one Francesco suggested is the CNO depletion in some stars. And the cluster he observed, he found a few CNO depleted Blue's stragglers, which he suggests is the material that was processed by a star and that was dumped onto the Blue's straggler. And this would explain the depletion in CNO. And another reason why to study mass transfer in a more general way is basically to understand how matter is deposited onto the accretor, and also how that changes the properties of the accreting star.
So, for the same reason why collision products do not mix well, after a collision, elements don't mix well, and it doesn't get rejuvenated very well. Mm-hmm. It should be true even for mass transfer.
Yeah, if you agree with the picture of entropy sorting that Fred was talking the other day, and that James Lombardi has worked on, for sure you're not going to mix like that. But we don't know how different the product for mass transfer is going to be from the collisional product, nice. Right? So,
finish your time.
So physically, is there any difference?
Well, so what you're saying, if you
take a turn-off star and you merge it with another star, that star is still going to be a turn-off star because you don't rejuvenate the core. If you're doing mass transfer, for these systems, you're doing mass transfer on a main sequence star, so that still has hydrogen in its core. The mass grows. Because the mass grows, the core grows. So there you can rejuvenate it.
No, but
biggest difference is time scale. Collision takes about 12 to 24 hours in real time. Mass transfer takes 10 to 9 years. A lot can happen to that mass, a little chunk of mass that comes over.
But if the collision happens early on, I mean, well, it's time for it to get its act together. If it, you know, a collision product, you're saying it takes 24 hours, but then there's all the time after that as well.
But that's only a thermal time to get back down to the main sequence. Oh, I know. Whereas the evolution of the boost driver that's accreting matter from the companion is going to be.
So basically, so this is why we want to do it. And it may sound simple at first sight, but it is rather challenging, especially from a computational point of view. It can be very expensive in CPU time and also in memory, and it's also very tricky, actually. And there's a few reasons for that. The first one is that the mass transfer rates can be fairly low. And that implies that the evolution of the system can be on a circular timescale, like 10 to 9 years or so. So this is, we can't do that.
It's not very low.
Well, if you want to dump like 0.5 solar mass at these rates, it's going to take a long time, right? My point here is that with a hydro code, we can't do that. We won't be able to evolve for 10 to the 9 years a hydro code, basically. So this is tricky. The second point is that in order to resolve where the matter is going to end up on the accreting star, and also if we want to resolve the stream, we need a fairly high spatial resolution, which in our case, as I'll show in the next slide, we're using SPH, so that translates into a number of particles.
Isn't a mass transfer rate that high associated with unstable mass transfer?
You need to get 10 to the minus 4 stably for winds from Yamsun.
That's different. There you are just losing mass. You're not putting it on another star.
It can be accreted at some level. So some people have come around some of these issues by not modeling the accreting star. Basically, they only use like a point mass or a sink particle, and matter is just being absorbed by this secondary star. But here, what we want to do is actually model the accretor. So we need to come up with some trick. So before I tell you what the trick is, I just want to say a few words on our tool, which is smoothed particle hydrodynamics. Stefan Roswald gave a really good introduction a few weeks ago about this. I'm not going to go over the whole story, but just say that SPH is a hydrodynamic technique that relies on the discretization of a fluid into smoothed particles. And these particles are subject to pressure gradients, gravity, and so on, viscosity too. So. And in this context, the density of a particle is calculated using a weighted summation. So basically, when we say a smoothed particle, it means that the particle is not a point mass. It occupies a volume. This volume is dictated by the smoothing kernel and also the smoothing length. Okay? And the density for one particle is going to be given by the degree of overlap of all the particles. The more they overlap, the higher the density is going to be, basically. So keep in mind that for the density of one particle, this summation only goes for a certain number of particles. It doesn't the sum doesn't go for all the particles in the star. So one particle has a given number of neighbors. That's what I'm saying. Just want to say that by construction, SPH also conserves energy as well as linear and angular momenta. But the use of a binary tree might alter this property, which we do in our case. All right, so what we want to do. So as I said, we need lots of particles if you want to resolve these objects. So what I have, so what we want to do basically is only model the outer parts of the stars. Okay, so we want to get rid of these particles where not much is happening during the mass transfer, and put all of our particles in the outer part. Okay, so what you see here is we've replaced the central particles by a central point mass, which only interacts via gravity. And these particles, the black dots, are actual SPH particles. But in order to maintain their position there, we need a boundary condition, which we achieve by using ghost particles. Ghost particles are pretty much like SPH particles, but the only difference being we don't evolve them. We just move them. And how do we move them? Well, we basically just move them according to the point mass. So you can see this as a big solid core that just moves. And you have the SPH particles on top of it. Okay?
We see it moving through space. Is that what we're seeing there?
Yeah, so basically it's rotating and it's also in translation. Okay? So so we think we nailed it down. We think this is behaving pretty well. And just for fun, we didn't do any science with it, but when I first got this result, I went on and just made a movie to see how the boundary would behave like under mass transfer. So this is just for fun, okay? So what you're looking at is a 0.8 solar mass red giant and a 0.8 main sequence, a 0.8 solar mass main sequence star with the boundary, okay? The blue dots are the point mass. It's not at the center. It's only like the movie program that does that, okay? But
don't worry, it's fine.
Yeah. So basically, it looks like the boundary is behaving really well. We're not seeing anything crazy. Everything's fine. Looks fine, okay? It just goes like that for a few minutes. I'm going to spare you this.
But please explain again why and how you distinguish between ghost and SPH particles. Why not all treating as SPH particles?
Because we want to put the actual SPH particle, the one that will change in time, the density and so on, we want to put them where it's interesting. That is the outer parts of the star, okay?
You can do your calculation in finite time.
Just the pressure.
Yeah, exactly. Because as I
said, okay, you have high density contrast, maybe.
Yeah, the thing is, you remember the equation for the density, it sums up over the neighbors. For a particle right at the boundary, if you don't put any other particles, there's going to be some neighbors missing. So you need to fill up this space. And we do so by using the ghost particles, actually.
So when you have too little density, then it's basically what you.
Pardon?
When you have too small a density, you just transfer the particle.
Oh, that density cut.
You need the pressure.
The ghosts provide the pressure gradient that maintains the SPH particle there.
You just put the particles hard against the boundary. They don't have any neighbors, and the scheme breaks down. So you have to have a neighbor there to deal with.
I'm just, but maybe please continue.
Maybe I can. We can discuss that later.
Okay.
Yeah.
So just because you do not have anything in the center. Isn't by construction prohibiting rejuvenation?
Yeah, we're not gonna send matter at the center. Okay, we're gonna see how matter accretes on the outer parts of the star. Okay, because as I said, we cannot evolve a system like this for 10 to the 9 years. We can't do that with hydro codes. Okay.
What you want to calculate at the end is mass transfer, mass accretion efficiency.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we want to see basically how matter is being accreted. Okay, because most people have only used point masses or sink particles. Okay, so and there's the latest example is this week on AstroPH. What's his first name? Rush. Sure. Rush, along with Melvin Davies and collaborators.
They were piped by radiation. Someone.
So and they actually model their accretor with a point mass. So anyway. So I wanted to show you this. Okay, so the movie looks fine. Okay, but when you having tested that, we went on and tested the code more to see if it was robust. And what we found right away is that if you take two SPH stars or different time kind of objects like point mass or a star or two stars or whatever, if you just take them, put them far apart, and just give them the right velocity to be on circular orbit, then the code behaves strangely, and well, actually we can't maintain a circular orbit. Okay, so the what you're looking at here is the normalized orbital separation as a function of time, and it changes. Okay, so there's something wrong with the code. So we looked at many different things.
How far away are the stars from each other?
Typically 4 or 5 radii, way inside their Roche, a solar radii, way inside their Roche globe.
Yeah,
okay, I'll come to that. So as I don't know if you can see the bottom line, but we look at many different things, and the last one with this initial conditions, as always. So basically what the part of the answer lied in the initial condition, okay? So the way we set up the stars is we relax one star, a single star, and then we relax another star, and then we take both of them, put them in the same solution, and let them go. But the thing is, you need to relax the two stars in their tidal fields, basically. And this is actually what Roswalks, Stefan has done in 2004, and also James Lombardi is going to present this soon. So basically, you need how we do that. This is just like some details. How you do that is, so you have your two stars, and if so, they're gonna want to come closer to each other. So basically, using this acceleration, you find the angular velocity that will counterbalance this inward pull, and then you reset the position. So basically, when you look at the star, they wobble. If you would put them close enough, you'd see that they would deform and form like some kind of lobe. And then you can, this way you make sure that they're fully relaxed and also synchronous. Okay, so as I said, this is part of the answer, okay? So I'm just gonna show you some movies here. There's nothing really interesting about them. It's just two stars, equal mass. We evolved them for many orbits, and it looks fine, all right? So there's nothing happening. So same thing, but different masses, basically mass ratio of close to 0.5 or something like that. We evolved these systems for like 5 orbits, and everything looks fine. The thing is, if you start looking, movies don't tell everything, that's the thing. If you look at numbers, okay, so what I'm plotting here, I'm plotting the normalized energy, so kinetic and total, gravitational, thermal, and the orbital separation. The black lines are for the equal mass binaries, well, the equal mass binary I just showed you, and the red one is for the unequal mass binary. So there is clearly something wrong with the unequal mass binary. This is where we're at right now. We're still not sure what's going on.
This is for the movie you just showed where the two stars are far enough.
Yeah.
And if you replace those two stars with 2 point masses, you don't have these problems.
Oh, I haven't done the point masses because our code cannot just do point masses.
Yeah, no, but just to make sure it's not the integration.
No, we tried many different things actually, different because we were using individual time steps, which makes the code faster, but may be a little bit tricky. So we looked at that. We looked at the initial conditions again. Maybe there's something with. Well, it's hard to tell what's going on with why there would be a difference, because both of these systems were relaxed using the same technique, the same everything. But for some reason, we still don't know why we can't.
Do you think it's linked to the interaction between orbital motion and internal degrees of freedom or not? That's why I was saying maybe with the point mass you can say it has nothing to do with them.
Okay, the one thing I tried is one SPH star and a point mass, and we still get the same thing.
And you also try to putting them really far away from each other, so you don't have much tides.
Yeah.
Okay. It's still the same problem.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you pick the number of neighbors, or how do you change your smoothing length between different?
Well, smoothing length is updated like in pretty much every SPH code. I'm not sure.
Well, so that's one of the things I think Stefan mentioned, is that people would just change it in an ad hoc way, which...
Yeah, okay, yeah, okay. What you're saying is, yes, we're using the vanilla, as Stefan was saying, the vanilla formulation of SPH, which is the one where we force or we change H, the smoothing length, by hand. We don't have the variational
It doesn't evolve according to...
But actually, Stefan compared these two formulations and he didn't see much difference. And for such a short time scale, we shouldn't see a difference either.
Okay. Have you tried or looked at fixing the smoothing length?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
So, for example, asymmetry of the smoothing length between I and J particles could be also an issue.
Yeah, that's the thing. These two stars have the same number of particles, but the thing is, one is much smaller. So the smoothing length of the 0.4 is going to be, the smoothing lengths are going to be smaller. So
I would probably check first the number of SPH particles and varying the force accuracy, then varying the smoothing lengths, and just see which one has an effect on this problem.
Yeah? Actually, varying the accuracy of the tree helps, but that comes at a really high cost, because the more accurate your tree is, the closer you get to an n-body type of calculation. So that comes at a price. But yes, increasing the accuracy really helps.
So would the problem go away if you go to full n-body?
Yes. Yeah.
Yes, the problem would go away.
The thing is, if we go back to my third slide or so, that what we want to do is have a high spatial resolution.
Oh,
right?
Sure.
So we want to have fairly high.
I'm not suggesting you
drop the binary tree and go to full n body.
If there's a smoothing length problem, it would not go away.
That's true. Yeah. So that's pretty much where we're at. We feel like we're really close to doing some science, but we're not quite there. So I'm just going to leave my summary. I'm just going to leave my summary.
Yes. With respect to your wobbles on the orbit, one of the biggest problems with n-body 6 is that they can't handle eccentric mass transfer. We're waiting for some description.
Mm-hmm.
Because starting the circular orbit up, circularization inside a triple, you have to induce eccentricity, and then circularize again, but that we could still be doing the Roche.
Yeah. Well, the thing is,
there's a whole treatise on this.
Yeah, and the paper by Rush and Melvin Davis, that's exactly what they looked at, the mass transfer between a star, one solar mass star, and the 0.6 point mass, or vice versa.
No, it's a 0.6 treating onto a one solar mass.
Yeah. And they're looking at mass transfer in an eccentric system, actually. That's what they did. The thing is, you want your system to evolve due to the mass transfer. You don't want your separation to be driven by numerics, right? So I don't see how we could model eccentric orbits if the separation and all that is driven by numerics. So I feel like we really have to nail this down.
When you solve all the problems, then you should also look at eccentric binary.
Yeah, that sounds good.
So is your intention to do circular orbits? Is that
well? No, we don't want to, we don't necessarily want to do circular orbits, but we want our goal to evolve systems. Correct. So that's why I'm doing circular orbits, because we know what their orbits should be.
It's a good test, but I mean, the question is, why not go into the rotating frame and do it as a problem in, you know, the co-rotating frame? Mm-hmm. And then you can track secular changes as long as they're long compared to the, you know, circular orbital timescale. As long as you're happy to be zero eccentricity, because then you don't have. I mean, you get your equilibrium presumably is a lot closer to being exactly satisfied.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Then you would need to add Coriolis and centrifugal trend to your equations of motion.
Yeah.
But it's a lot easier. I mean, this is like trying to balance a spring, you know, with its rotating around in front of you as opposed to hopping on it and just sort of sitting there exactly below the leg and rotating front.
Thank you.
Thank you.